This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. I tend to get chatty when I'm nervous, so a few years ago, as I was lying on my side in an operating room watching the surgical team prepare for my procedure, I just started making small talk with the anesthesiologist. Now, I know what you're thinking. A gentleman of a certain age tipped over on his side in an operating room must have been one of those procedures, you know what I mean? One of those little camera-on-the-probe type deals. So you're probably wondering why I was nervous. I mean, those things are pretty routine. And as anyone who's ever had a colonoscopy will tell you, by the time you're on the table, the worst part, which is the preparation, is over. Fortunately, it was not that kind of procedure. I was there for a bone marrow biopsy. Spoiler alert, turned out to be nothing. But those words in that order are a pretty alarming combination. So as the nurse was inserting the IV and the doctor was issuing gruff orders, I asked the anesthesiologist what I thought was a simple question. How does anesthesia work anyway? I asked breezily as a nurse was drawing a black circle with a Sharpie at the base of my spine. The circle was there to guide the surgical drill that was going to pierce my skin and bone to the marrow and extract a sample of the gooey whatever it is. How exactly anesthesia works actually seemed like a relevant subject for conversation. And the anesthesiologist smiled awkwardly and had the expression of someone who was trying not to say something. I mean, I went on, it's not like sleep, right? If I'm asleep and you drill into me, I'm going to wake up. So how does this work? Well, you know, it's complicated, he said. There are competing theories. Theories, I said, moving away from the drill apparatus. Well, no, not theories, he said. More like guesses. It's just one of those things that, at which point the surgeon looked up sharply at the anesthesiologist who got the message and turned the knob that began to flood my IV with propofol. So, wait, you're telling me that we have no idea how, and that was all I got out before the drug hit? Now, however it does its job, propofol, I am here to tell you, works really, really well. I did not feel a thing. And I thought about that moment recently when I read an article in Scientific American, I think, with the disconcerting title, "No One Can Explain Why Planes Stay in the Air." Now, I went to some pretty elite schools, so I am an expert at pretending to know and understand things that I am totally clueless about. But I'll spare you that act and just tell you the truth. I never really got physics. Ever since the moment in middle school science when they tried to get me to accept that a heavy thing and a light thing fall at the same rate, I mean, that's just crazy, right? Whenever I hear physics stuff, I just tune out. But I'll do my best to summarize the article. There are two competing theories that address the question of aerodynamic lift. One of them explains it this way. The air moving on top of the wing is moving faster than the air moving underneath the wing. The top side of the wing is curved and the bottom side of the wing is flat, and that creates a low pressure zone above the wing, and that creates lift, and that would be that, except it doesn't explain how planes can fly upside down, which they can. Now, the other theory is from Isaac Newton. And it's basically this, that air has mass, so the wing pushes air down, that's the action, and that pushes the wing up, that's the reaction, but that doesn't explain the other theory. And what I've learned from physics is you really do need to tie it all up in a neat little package. Now, research is apparently underway to explain exactly why planes don't fall out of the sky, but in the meantime, you know, we're all just standing at the gate trying to sneak into group two with our wheelies and our Cinnabons, blissfully uninterested in how it all works or does not. And you know, when they drilled into my spine and they extracted some marrow and tested it and found, to my intense relief, basically nothing, I didn't restart my investigations into the nature of propofol. I took the good news, and I didn't ask any questions. And I laugh about it now because that's what we do. That's what we're called to do when things happen that are scary or confusing or that we just don't understand. I tell people a story about bone marrow biopsies and invisible airplane physics, and they laugh because, I mean, what else are you going to do? We tend to laugh about the big things, death and disease and danger, the mystery of flight. So I guess what I'm asking show business is, why aren't we making comedies about this stuff anymore? I mean, shouldn't we all be doing that? Especially now when the news is bad, when the world seems like it's falling apart. I mean, I know, it always seems like it's falling apart, but this time it might actually really be falling apart. And that, to me, as a writer who has spent decades in the comedy business, I mean, that just spells opportunity. I mean, there's no elegant way to put that, really. But when times are bad, Hollywood does really well. There are news channels and social media platforms pumping out war and hate and anger and outrage and misery and dark all the time. So those of us who work in the entertainment side of things, I mean, the actual entertainment side of things, not the news side that's also the entertainment side. Well, this is our chance to step up and tell some really great funny stories. And if you write comedy like me, it's a chance to do some really funny stuff. And I don't mean that comedy has to be purely trivial escape either. I mean, the funniest things, as we all know, are the truest ones. So the hardest part of the next story I'm about to tell you is believing this sentence, which I promise is true, although I think we both know it's rare. I was in the locker room at the gym. It does happen, I promise. But as I was dressing, a well-toned man with a locker next to mine had just come from the shower, and he sees another friend a few lockers down. That friend is portly and balding. So we have two guys. One super fit, the other not at all, and then me, the third, just minding my own business. The two friends greet each other. "Hey, how are you?" says the fit one. "I'm okay," says the other one, sort of downcast. "How about you?" "I'm doing great," says the fit one, with a slight and almost imperceptible body shift, as if to say, "I mean, look at me. I am barely 3% body fat." Now, the 30% body fat guy shrugs, which I guess inspired his leaner, fitter friend to look him up and down and then say this: "You have gained some weight." Not in an unkind way. Well, I guess there's not a nice way to say that, but it came out like it was a guy just trying to be blunt and friendly at the same time, which, of course, all decent people know is impossible. I mean, we don't want our friends to be blunt. We want our friends to be friendly and, whenever possible, to tell us encouraging lies about ourselves. "I mean, like 30 pounds, asked the guy, veering away from blunt, friendly, and into blunt, jerky territory. "Well, 25, the other guy said, just to set the record straight. And there was an awkward silence, which I hoped was the end of it, because I was now, you know, tying my shoes and was about to leave. I didn't want to have to make eye contact. But the other guy, for some reason, wasn't done clarifying the reasons for his unexpected weight gain. "I had cancer," he said. "A bone tumor. They removed it, and I just haven't been able to exercise for a while." "Oh," said the blunt guy. And not in the way like you or I would say it, like, "Oh, wow, I am so sorry and so embarrassed." But more like, "Oh, I am registering that statement that you just made." But the other guy was done, I guess, explaining himself, and he moved off to the showers. "Nice to see you again," he said, in a way that suggested that it was not, in fact, nice to see him again. And they waved, and he moved off, and now it was just me, tying my second shoe, and the blunt, fit guy who stood there for some reason and then muttered loudly to himself, "He didn't have cancer." And I'm about to leave when he mutters again, "Cancer makes you skinny." Which is a hilariously awful and mean thing to say, but as I was walking out of the gym and shaking my head at the darkly comic scene that just took place, I actually found myself thinking, you know, I think cancer does make you skinny, which sort of makes the whole thing funnier. I mean, and I keep thinking about that because, well, you know, for the past month or so, I've been working on an idea for a script that doesn't seem, you know, at first funny, and I'll tell it to people and they'll say, "Oh, that's interesting, but is it a comedy?" And I always say, "Yeah, of course." And they always say, "Okay, well, good luck with that." And what I've discovered, and maybe it's just me, is that everything is potentially funny. I mean, everything is potentially a comedy. And I know, yes, everything is not funny. Some things are too awful or evil or disgusting, frankly, to be funny. I used to do these commentaries for Irish radio and tell a story I told, which is describing some insensitive jokes that involved the Holocaust, offended listeners, or maybe just one listener, and that was that. And I'm not arguing that point either. I'm just saying that making jokes about something, making light of something, laughing at something doesn't mean it's not awful or serious or important. Mostly it means it's so big and so dark and so real that laughing is kind of all we can do. I mean, we're experts anyway at telling our life stories and framing our experiences as tragedies. But in the great middle gray zone where most of us live, frankly, it's pretty much a comedy, or at least that's what we in the business call a dramedy, which, as we know, is just a comedy that moves at a slower pace. And we're great anyway at seeing ourselves as doomed heroes or hapless victims or romantic ingenues. I mean, that makes sense, of course, because human beings are the only animals on Earth who know they're going to die. That didn't need a spoiler alert, right? And so the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves naturally tend to that format, that kind of play, the kind where everybody ends up dead on stage and somebody gives a sad speech and then it's over. But mostly, honestly, life is sort of funny. It's a dark funny, maybe, but it's sort of funny. A mean, fit guy at the gym and his fatter friend who either did or did not have a tumor that caused him to stop exercising and gain weight. I mean, that's kind of ruefully, humanly funny, especially if that fat guy is, in fact, lying about it all because he just ate too much bread and didn't want to admit it. I mean, if you're listening to this right now, it means that you're up and about and not lying in a pile on stage with Hamlet and Lear and Agamemnon and Desdemona. And that means that the story you're telling to yourself and everyone else, that story is a comedy. And really, isn't that good? That's good news, right? I mean, when we laugh, we are really at our best. Our faces are all screwed up, and we look like gargoyles, and we tear up, and our breathing is weird. We never look heavier or uglier than we do when we laugh. And that alone is a reason to make sure we do it every day or more. When we laugh, we are disarmed. Because laughter is involuntary. Someone or something makes us do it. They make us lose our breath and gasp for air. It's like they're strangling us. And it's kind of fun to be out of breath and lightheaded because of that. Now, comedy writers often have a hard time letting go like that. True professionals in the comedy business, when someone says something funny, they don't laugh. They just say, oh, that's funny. Just like that. And it's never clear if they truly think it's funny, but have just run out of laughter juice, or if jealousy, that someone else has said something funny and you have to squash that, if jealousy just takes over in that nano moment between punchline and response. I mean, I have a friend who told me that when he was a young writer just starting out, he was lucky enough to have a dinner with a true comedy legend, one of the funniest and most spontaneous performers ever. The performer was a star, so of course he monopolized the conversation and the laughs, but my friend managed to sneak in a funny little comment, and when the rest of the table was through laughing at that, the star fixed him with a deadly and cold stare. "I work alone," he said. And he wasn't kidding either. When my friend tells that story, we always laugh, but it's not really a funny story, is it? I mean, the older star was a miserable, angry person who simply couldn't be generous with anyone else or himself. Now, I am not a licensed psychiatrist, but the phrase "I work alone" is something that I would write down in the notes during my session with that old comedian, adding beside it, "V significant." It's not a funny story, but we laugh, which makes it a funny story, even though it's sad. Sort of like, you know, everything. So let me tell you another story, and I know I'm going a bit longer here, but here goes. It's a sad story, but it's also funny. On the morning that my father died, we were all together in the bedroom, and yes, I know, but there's a laugh here, I promise. The family were all having breakfast together and talking, and it was clear that my dad could hear us. I mean, he knew we were all there together. And so at a certain point, I went downstairs to put a couple of bagels in the toaster, and I had just put the toaster lever down, you know, little thing, when my brother ran downstairs and said, "Rob, Dad just died." And so I ran up to the bedroom, and it was awful. There was tears and sobs. The worst day of my life, basically. And my mother was saying goodbye to the man she had known for 60 years. We were saying goodbye to our father and our grandfather. Again, worst moment of my life. It was this expected, unexpected, big thing. And in that moment, there was nothing to do for any of us except, you know, wail in heartbreak. But a small part of me knew that there were also two bagels in the toaster downstairs, and you know how that is, right? When they pop up, they sometimes don't pop up all the way, and they get stuck, and they burn, and the kitchen fills with black smoke. And so for some reason, in the middle of the worst misery I've ever felt, I mean, my father was my hero, and he was gone. In the middle of that, I suddenly looked up and said to my nephew, "Would you mind going downstairs to check the bagels?" Which he immediately did, glassy-eyed and shocked, suddenly initiated to the very real heartbreak of being alive. And a few moments later, he reappeared and said in a quiet, very grown-up voice, "The bagels are fine." Which means that even in my worst moment, in that awful, sobbing, desolate moment, some part of me was thinking, this is really terrible. But you know what would make it worse? If the smoke alarms went off. Which, let's face it, is kind of funny. And then later that day, when we were all sitting quietly, still stunned but pulled together, I suddenly looked over at my nephew and I said, "Hey, thanks for dealing with the bagels this morning." And he nodded, and then we both sort of realized how strange that moment was, and we both laughed a little, which we both needed to do at that moment, which everyone needs to do. And this is a very long way to say that when the world seems like it's falling apart, if you write comedy or produce comedy or love comedy, the trick isn't to look away from the terrible things happening, but to look directly at them. Charlie Chaplin once explained that there are two ways to film the old guy slips on a banana peel joke. The first unfunny way goes like this. You cut to the guy walking, oblivious. Then you cut to the banana peel, lying in wait. Then you cut to a wide shot of the guy approaching the banana peel. You cut to a close-up of the banana peel just as the guy's foot hits it. And you cut back to the wide shot as the guy slips on the peel and lands on his ass, which, as everybody knows from cartoons, is the funniest part of the human body and one which registers no real pain. Now, the second funny way to film the same sequence is as follows. You cut to the guy walking, you cut to the banana peel lying in wait, you cut to the wide shot of the guy approaching the banana peel, you cut to a close-up of the banana peel just as the guy's foot almost hits it, and then you cut back to the wide shot as the guy deftly steps over the banana peel, smiling smugly, and then he falls into an open manhole. See the difference? The trick is to make sure the audience never really knows what part is the setup and what part is the joke until they start laughing, which is probably all they can do, really, because we've all slipped on a banana peel. We've all thought we had something figured out. We have all faced something big and real and scary and laughed anyway. And that's it for this week. Next week, much, much shorter, I promise. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long.